Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 136 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast. There's a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is my wonderful hostess, Aaron Paulette. I mean, I already know the answer to this, but how are you doing, Aaron?
We almost made it a week. Almost a week into 2021. Yeah. So, I mean, I know we're going to talk about that later, and I'm so looking forward to it. But first, we've got the banter, and you told me that you made some of my Black Eyed Pea dip, and I would like to know how it came out.
I did, and I mean, I was texting you while I was doing it, and I was just like, well, I don't know if I did this right, but
you know. But why not?
I mean, I never know. That's one of those things. As someone who is constantly reading over cocktail recipes, I will sometimes see a cocktail and be like, oh, that looks interesting. I will mix it and I will drink it. And I'd be like, oh, that tastes really good. But I don't know if that is exactly what was intended. I mean, I've got my own recipe for the Vesper cocktail from Casino Royale. And I have modified it slightly from how it appears in the book because the way I modified it, I like it better. But it's one of those, like, did I modify it away from the original? I don't know. And then I go to a bar and I order a Vesper martini. And you know what? It's as close. I mean, they're all over the map. That's a bad example. But you know what? That's pretty good. So there is that question of the I have never had this thing before, and so I've made something that was quite delectable. But at the same time, is it drastically different from what you enjoy? I don't know. Probably not too different.
All I'm gonna say is that if it tastes good, you did it right.
I mean, it's tasty. I do like it. I do like it. And I will say that I used my cheese sauce instead of the craft stuff. I don't even know if we can get that stuff here. But it's a cheddar cheese sauce. So I had made a cheddar cheese sauce for to put over some cauliflower the other night, and so it went. And I did not find the ranch beans, and so I took out a little bit of the butter and added a little bit of bacon grease to the mix. And there was also a little bit of bacon grease in the cheese sauce because, oh my God, cheese sauce with bacon grease is so good. And I decided to make it more family friendly. So instead of adding the full three jalapenos, I just took the biggest, fattest jalapeno that I had bought and threw that sucker in there. And of course, I was talking to David a little earlier. I was saying, Aaron said one clove of garlic. I said, oh, silly Aaron. Who writes this sort of stuff on the internet? I think David is known of saying, yes, you know, you know those circular things that you buy in the garlic bin? That is a clove.
So what was your delivery system of choice?
I had baked a loaf of whole wheat bread this morning, and so I toasted it up and spread it over the toast.
Oh, very nice.
It was very nice. Like literally, it was that, like, I made a little bit more of an elaborate lunch this afternoon. And I'm just like, yeah, and we got leftovers in the fridge. Let's just have leftovers. So I had like a little bit of leftover cheeseburger mac, and I made some zucchini tots a few days ago, and my wife and I polished those off. And like literally, I was like eating all the food like on the kitchen counter, standing up as I was, you know, messing with other stuff and making food for my daughter and all that. So it was very scumbaggery, as I like to say. My wife, I got back from the grocery store and I was really hungry, and I'm like, what should I have? And I'm like, oh, I made some vegetable soup earlier. And so I opened up the container and it had already been taken some vegetable soup out of it. So it was relatively small. So I split it up into two single serving containers, and there was just enough left for one more. And my wife came down the stairs as I was drinking the warmed vegetable soup out of the large container. Like just directly with two hands, like I was sipping from a gigantic cup. And I looked at my wife and I'm sorry you had to see me like this. She goes, I know, you do the dishes. You don't want to make an extra dirty dish.
I expected you would quote from Iron Man. Let's face it, you've seen me doing worse.
I mean, that's also true.
Are you one of those weird married couples who uses the bathroom with the door open?
I mean, I'm not particularly concerned whether it's opened or closed. Sometimes it's closed, sometimes it's not.
Uh-huh, but what about her?
A little bit more private, but but also less concerned. Or if I'm brushing my teeth, it's just screw it.
Well, I'm brushing your teeth, who cares? But I mean, you know, we're talking about you see me doing worse things. It's like, I just wonder if you're, you know, you're there dropping a deuce and the door is open and she's
two activities that needs to be closed. Number one, just because nobody wants to see that. And number two, you run the fan and with the door closed, it's ample circulation. You can cover up the evidence much faster that way.
Oh, okay. So door open for number one, door shut for number two.
That's correct.
Okay.
I mean, if we had a big enough lawn, it'd be one of those, like, I'd just be out in the backyard. I'm a field
biologist. In the backyard?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a field biologist. We're barely housebroken.
Okay.
But Aaron, thank you for this cultural culinary education that is the Black Eyed Pea Dip. It was delicious, welcome. And no need to put it again in the show notes. I mean, I guess if we wanted to, but yeah, you can go back to episode 135 and just have a look at that. And I would say, well worth it. It was tasty, and yeah, it's good on chips. It's good on bread. So yeah. I like it, and I'm pretty sure this is going to be like my go-to snack for like the next week.
Oh, cool.
Ooh, I'm going to try dipping celery in it. That might be tasty. We'll see.
Probably. Oh. I mean, it'll certainly cover up the awful taste of celery.
I was just about to ask where you sit on the celery. My wife is definitely on the level of the celery is abhorrent and bad, and I was kind of that mindset that I didn't like celery, and my wife absolutely hates it. And so I found that whenever we got like buffalo wings at a restaurant and they came with the carrot sticks and the celery sticks, per somebody wrote a rule somewhere, I would always like before I even would touch the chicken, I would eat all of the celery sticks just because it had been ages since I had had one. And then my daughter ate some like celery sticks at my mother-in-law's house with cream cheese on them, and she loved it. And so she was small at the time. And so when you have a small child that likes something that's reasonably healthy, you just like, oh, buy a bunch of it. And also, if you have a small child that likes something reasonably healthy, when you go and buy a whole bunch of it, they won't eat it anymore. And so I found that I was eating the celery and just like, all right, I'm just going to get rid of this. I'll snack on the celery. It's fine. And later I found out, you know what? I actually kind of really like the taste of celery. So I'm kind of into it.
Okay.
And I make it a rule of I like to hide celery in different foods that I feed my wife.
You know, okay. In foods is fine. You know, you make a vegetable soup, you chop up the celery, I'm cool with that. And you want to give me a plate of crudité and I can dip it in ranch sauce, okay, that's fine, because I taste the ranch and the celery gives it a crunch. I'm cool with that. But just, here is a green vegetable that tastes like nothing. I mean, okay, it's better than cilantro, but that's not a very high bar.
Ooh, are you of the genetic morph that the cilantro tastes like soap to you?
Yes.
Oh, that's too bad. Oh, I love cilantro. But again, okay. you would not. That is not you having bad taste. It's just you are of the genetic morph where it tastes awful. And then the other genetic morph, well, actually, my wife is different. My wife, it does not taste like soap to her. She just doesn't like the taste of cilantro. Well, Aaron, shall we rush through this grim menagerie that we have here?
Leroy Jenkins.
Yeah, yeah. I understand. I'm a bit glum about this, but I've kind of come on that. If you listen to this show and the scope of this show, you're going to probably expect us to talk about it. And but honestly speaking, on the nonpartisan nature of this, there's not really a whole lot to talk about. There was without getting partisan on it, but yeah, there was a riot on the Capitol. You guys all know about it at this point in time. You don't need us to tell you about it. If by chance you aren't aware of what we're talking about, good.
I envy you.
Yeah. Yep. Just say, oh yeah, it's one of Weird's long rambling stories, probably about nothing. So and just move on with your life. But it was bad, and I think what's going to be worse is going to be what it's going to trigger, the reaction to it. And essentially the reaction that I wanted to talk about, mostly because this is something that we can do, is there have been a number of bills proposed. These are all House of Representative bills, and I just wanted to do, as far as I know, let me just do a quick refresh on my tab. The text has not been added to any of these yet, as far as I can see. So we don't have specifics on them, but the titles are, I would argue, descriptive enough. And so I will just go down them and just give a brief my interpretation of them, and we can call that good. But essentially, first one is HR 121. These are all in the show notes as well, so the text might be uploaded, you know, by the time you're listening to this. I don't know. To provide the hiring of 200 additional Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosive agents. And that part, I actually don't have a whole lot of problem with. I could see that being good. I could see that being bad. These could be agents that are helping us with our suppressors, our form ones, and all of that stuff, getting new gun shops up and running, auditing gun shops that might be a problem. You know, that's fine. But then they specifically say agents and investigators to enforce gun laws. Given the nature of the other stuff I'm going to read, I see this very much like in the state of Massachusetts, where the wait time has only gone up and gone up for your renewal of your permit. And but at the same time, when Mara Healey passed her edict banning all assault weapons and making AR-15s completely illegal under any circumstance, you can buy an AR in California. You cannot in Massachusetts. She hired additional agents so that they could review all of the registrations. And I've talked to gun shops that said that they've sold rifles to police officers for duty use, and shortly after that transfer went through, they got a phone call wanting them to detail the information about that transfer because they were concerned that he was breaking the law. So yeah, this is one of those where we're not hiring these people to do the good stuff. We're hiring to do the bad stuff. Next up, what kind of bad stuff? HR 125, to amend Title 18 United States Code to provide a 7-day waiting period before semi-automatic firearm, a silencer, armor-piercing ammunition, or large capacity ammunition magazine may be transferred. So yeah, this is a 7-day waiting period, which is the dumbest law ever, ever, ever. As I've said in my weird audio fisks, the 7-day waiting period was started by the Brady Bill, and essentially it created enough time for the 4473 to travel by post mail to the ATF office for them to run the background check, and then it might have gone to the FBI, but wherever it went, they ran the background check by hand, and then they would mail the response back to the gun shop, and that was expected to take 7 days or less. And because of the, you know, and that was where the waiting period went through. And of course, anti-gunners, if it makes gun people happy, we can't have that. So anti-gunners kept it, and they turned it around to like a cooling off period or some other nonsense that was just invented out of whole cloth. And the bottom line is, if you've got, say, you know, 30 or 40 various high capacity magazines, what is that 7-day waiting period going to be doing for you? If you've got dozens of guns at home and now you're buying a new one, like, this is not specifying, or at least it never has. It may in this text, I doubt it, you know, a cooling off period for your very first gun. Okay, I could see logic in that. It's still unconstitutional. It's still evil. It's still wrong. But I could at least see logic, and that logic does not exist here. And of course, also adding 7 days to the transfer of a silencer.
Yeah, a suppressor where you already have to pay $200 and fill out a form and allow the ATF to crawl up your rear end. And that takes, oh, how many months is the wait now these days?
Give or take 6 months is my understanding.
But we've got to have an additional 7 days just to cool off.
Yeah, exactly. It may have been a year when you started this, a year ago when you started this process, and we're going to add one more week to it because screw you.
And I want to know, well, actually, I think I know the answer, but I want to hear you say it. When they say armor-piercing ammunition, do they mean round nose?
I don't even know. I mean, this is one of those ones where I'm very confident that there will not be any sort of stipulation for if you have previously bought a large capacity ammunition magazine or a semi-automatic firearm that you will not need to cool off because you've already got half a dozen guns at home. One more is not going to turn you into a one man army. You only got the two hands. But the definition of armor piercing ammunition could be anything. I mean, so we had the whole ban of green tip ammunition that I think we should all, it's fresh enough that we should all remember it. And the argument for that was because it would penetrate level 2 ballistic armor, which is only rated for shotguns and handguns. So literally anything, your standard issue deer shooting guns will go right through a standard police officer vest. It is.
I mean, I don't even know why that's an issue, because even if we're talking soft armor, police these days use level 3A, don't they?
I think it all depends on the department. I think I certainly have heard some police officers in some relatively small towns who have elected to have trauma plates in their carrier. But I think in some cases it may be an option. You may choose to wear a soft armor if you may even be given a choice to be wearing armor or no armor. So it is more or less irrelevant, because yes, police can up armor, and again, level 3 armor is getting real, real light and real, real comfy.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't even talking about level 3. I was talking about level 2A, and the point being, okay, level 2 is, I guess, softer and better for undercover, but it's like you can get really good soft level 3A. Now, neither of them will stop a rifle bullet, which is what the green tip was. Mm-hmm. Because soft armor just doesn't stop rifles. You need hard armor for that. Mm-hmm. But I just didn't understand why level 2 was really a thing anymore when we've got much better protection for the same relative amount of bulk.
Yeah, I think at the time of the one that was written, I think it was Ted Kennedy that brought that one up ahead.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah, it was at that point in time, it was level 2 was pretty, or 2A was pretty much what the average beat officer was wearing around. And even to get into any of the 3A categories, that was for the SWAT teams.
Mary Jo Kopechne was unavailable for comment.
Yes, that is absolutely true. Thank you, Aaron, for taking a stab at him, because he was a horrible person. And I say that in the most nonpartisan sense. If you're a Democrat, you should think he's terrible. So I don't know what armor-piercing ammunition is. At this point in time, it could be anything, because, of course, who knows? They could say to pierce armor, it needs to go through a flak vest. In which case, like a 32 auto could probably make its way through. So who knows? Who knows what this means? But I guarantee, I will put money down that the definition will be ludicrous.
Yeah.
The next one is HR 127, to provide for licensing of firearms and ammunition possession and the registration of firearms, and to prohibit the possession of certain ammunition. This is the poll tax. This is welcome to Massachusetts. And let me tell you, as a Massachusetts resident, this is the worst of all of them, because this one right here is just horror. Because again, during the Obama gun rush, my main permit expired. And so I put in early and, you know, put in early for the renewal and all of that. And it took them, I think, an additional like month or two to get the permit back. The just demand was so high that I think they even apologized to me, you know, when I was calling about the status of the permit. I'm so sorry. We're working as hard as we can. The demand is just tremendously high. Nobody expected this and all that.
When government apologizes, you know it's going to be bad.
Yeah. Well, it's also the state of Maine. So, I mean, that's one of those states where, you know, a wrong number calls and you talk to them for 2 hours and then they come over for dinner. So yes, and in that case, I mean, in the state of Maine, I could open carry if I wanted to, and I could still own my guns, and I could still have guns with me. I just could not carry concealed at the time. And so, I mean, we could argue they've now gone constitutional carry. So even if the, you know, your permit expires and you're renewing your permit and you're still electing to keep your main permit, it doesn't really change anything if they're taking their time getting it renewed. In Massachusetts, I have been like going to the gun range or deciding whether I want to go to the gun range because I have an expired permit that is technically still valid because we have grace periods that are built into the laws for this. But literally owning a firearm suddenly becomes a crime when that permit expires. And so if they are dragging their feet, just the fact that you have guns at home is now a crime. And so, yeah, this is no good. And of course, also, this is an option for shall issue or may issue permitting. There's this issue for increasing fees. This is issue for demanding stipulations such as, contacting your employer. Delaware requires you to put out an ad in the paper that says you are requesting a concealed carry permit.
What?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, they have just all sorts of things that are designed just to be a chilling factor, are just designed for... I went to a gun range with a friend of mine, and he started shooting my guns, and he was having a great time. And finally, he started talking about costs. He's like, "So how much does this gun cost?" And I started telling him, and he's an engineer, so he was making some pretty good money. So he was not getting the sticker shock that some people would on the cost of a new 1911 or the cost of a Smith & Wesson revolver. And he was like, "Oh yeah, that's not bad. I could swing that and all that." And he goes, "So anything else I need to do?" "Yeah, there's a permit that you need to get, and here's what you need to do." And literally after I explained all of that to him, he said, "I'll just shoot with you." And that is what victory looks like for them. So again, this is the most abhorrent and the most blatantly unconstitutional. We can argue that every last one of these that I'm reading are unconstitutional, including hiring ATF agents and the existence of the ATF entirely, but that's arguable. This, if anybody's arguing that this is not against the U.S. Constitution, they are from crazy town. Next up, we have H.R. 130 to require safe storage of firearms and ammunition and require investigation of reports of improper storage of firearms and ammunition. So this is also blatantly unconstitutional per Heller versus D.C. They said you can't do this. You cannot require to locking up of firearms and safe storage of firearms. But it also looks like there is going to be a nice stipulation for people to think on their friends, relatives, and neighbors.
Yeah. Knock, knock, knock. Mr. Weird, we understand you have guns. We need to inspect the premises to ensure that they are locked up in an appropriate gun safer cabinet. Right?
Oh, yeah.
And I don't hear anything in there about a warrant. Mm-mm. I could be wrong. Did I miss that? Is would they have to get a warrant, or is it just, well, someone did a report and we've got to investigate?
Well, I mean, if the license comes through, that could be a stipulation on that. I mean, there's, when I was a federal fisheries observer, literally when I said hi to a captain and shook his hand and asked when he was going out on his next fishing trip, I tried to be polite about it, but I was essentially telling him that he had an extra bunk that was going to get filled for that trip, because per the license that he has to commercially fish, issued by the United States government, it said that if an agent of the United States government wanted to come along to collect scientific data, they did not have the right to refuse that. So it could be a stipulation in the license on the, if you own a gun, you've pretty much just waived any rights to privacy or your Fourth Amendment rights as well. Yeah.
Yep.
And the last one that I want to read is, this one is, I can see as being not too bad, probably, depending on how it's written. But a real, real do not underestimate this one, is HR 167. To prohibit the transfer of a firearm at a gun show by a person who is not a federally licensed firearm dealer. And so, I don't know, there may be people here who have not been to gun shows, but one of the things you will sometimes see at gun shows is you might actually have somebody, if they're liquidating their collection, they may get themselves a table. They aren't a licensed dealer, but they're looking to get rid of several guns enough that it's worth them spending a little bit of money to get a table for the visibility. But another thing you'll see is people walking around with a gun in a holster or a rifle or a shotgun slung over a shoulder with a price tag hanging off of it. And literally you can just look and it'll say, you know, $250 for this shotgun. And you can just tap them on the shoulder and say, excuse me, sir, is that $250 for that shotgun? As a matter of fact, I've got $250 here. And if you live in a free state, unlike Massachusetts, you could essentially exchange, money for the firearms right then and there. I will state that every time an anti-gun group has attempted to go to a gun show to show that no questions are asked and people are not perturbed by potentially selling guns to felons and all that, they are always foiled on anyone that says anything sketchy while the transfer is going on. The transfer quickly ends and the money is returned, or anybody who will not provide a state ID so that they can at least make sure that they are not transferring the firearms across state lines. Or to an out-of-state resident, that always happens. But where I can see this as being scary, at a gun show, it's not the end of the world, because one of the things that I complain about with the universal background check bill is the fact that you may have to travel. Like if you're in a rural area or all that, it may be an hour's drive for you to get to the nearest gun shop. And so if your next-door neighbor who lives up the road wants to sell you his deer rifle that he doesn't want anymore, you guys both need to get in your cars, or one car if you're going to get a carpool, and drive hours to get to a gun store, wait in line, you know, pay the gun store owner for his or the guy behind the counter for their time, transfer the firearm, and then drive back home. And that itself is a bad thing. And gun show, you're going to be able to find a licensed dealer. And so it might cost you another $20 to $50, depending on how things do that. That's not the end of the world. That's not the scariest thing. The thing that does scare me is if this is as narrow as I think it is, it could get very, very dangerous in the fact that if they do specify that it needs to be at a gun show or a trade show where this is prohibited, in theory, you could go out into the parking lot, or you could give somebody your card and they could call you after the show and then complete the transaction outside of the legal scope of this bill, of which case the anti-gun people can do a follow-up on the, all they have to do is go out into the parking lot or go, follow each other home, and then they can do this outside. This law, they can sidestep it. It is a loophole and it needs to be closed. And mm-hmm. This is, I really see this as as a bill that is designed to get the camel's nose under the tent, like specifically. Yep. I mean, there is the people that say, oh, everything's a slippery slope, everything's a conspiracy and all that. But I think this one is very, very specifically designed to be a slippery slope, much like medical marijuana laws quickly led to recreational marijuana laws. And that was the whole point. It was never intended as a medical thing. There might be some medical, additives to it, but it was designed exclusively to get to recreational and as a stepping stone. And I see this absolutely as that stepping stone.
Now, I don't know if you're done or not, but if you are, that's a great segue.
Why, thank you, Aaron. I was done. The only bow I want to put on that one is the reason why I read these all off and have them in the show notes and just briefly talked about them is that we need to get in front of this. And so you need to contact specifically your House of Representatives, because these are all House bills. And so contact your representative, let them know, both talk about how the fact that these are just bad bills and they shouldn't support them. But even if they're a little bit soft on the gun stuff, they may not be a real Second Amendment supporter. You do need to point out like how blatantly unconstitutional several of these are and state that they are really inviting signing onto a law that might get struck down by the Supreme Court. We need to get ahead of this. This is something that you can do, especially if you are like Aaron and I, and you are sitting at home very depressed about what is going on. Doing things helps.
Well, unlike you, I no longer have any faith that contacting my federal Congress critter is going to do anything. But I'm really glad that you brought up medical marijuana leading to recreational marijuana. That's a great analogy. And I think that the gun people can learn a lot from the weed people. And there are, in fact, two articles in the show notes talking about exactly that. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to make an analogy here, and I may need to explain what I'm talking about. So hopefully our listeners know what jury nullification is. If you don't, here's a really quick primer. Let's say that you are in favor of marijuana possession. And you are picked to serve on a jury where someone is convicted of, having marijuana. And the prosecution does its job. And they have convinced you, yes, this person broke the law. And according to the law, they should go to jail. There is no doubt in your mind that they are guilty. But you say, you know what? I disagree with marijuana laws. So I don't care how good a job the prosecution did. I'm voting not guilty. That's known as jury nullification. It is a thing that exists. It is a tool in your toolbox. Unfortunately, the courts really hate it when people know about it. So if you ever want to get out of jury duty, you can mention jury nullification and you will be thrown out, and maybe even the other people who hear you say that word. Because the prosecutors and the judges really hate it. I'm not entirely sure how defense attorneys feel about it.
Well, the scary thing about it is, and I would imagine probably most of them don't like it, because also jury nullification, if in fact you convince the jury to state that, yes, we agree that the defendant is guilty, but we decline to prosecute on account of the law being unjust, that is legal precedent. So you actually can change the law right there, just as when a judge takes a interpretation of the law as something and charges somebody with a crime because they were here in Massachusetts. There was a case where a woman was harassing her boyfriend over the phone while he was in a distraught state, and he ended up killing himself. And she got charged with, I can't remember if it was murder or manslaughter, but she was charged as being party to his death, even though they were not in the same room, not in the same area. And that can be brought up again on the fact that this woman went to prison for doing this act resulting in the death of somebody. And so you could also say that this person was possessing marijuana, but even though they were doing it and they were guilty of doing it, the jury has said this is not something that we need to prosecute.
Right. Thanks for interrupting. Okay, so that's jury nullification. So if you want to be on a jury, don't know. So if you want to be on a jury, don't admit that you know about it. If you want to get out, you can say it. So there is a similar process going on, and we can nullify laws at a state level. Now, we have a harder time of it, but here's what's going on. Again, using marijuana. Marijuana is still a federal prohibited substance. It's class one. It's right up there with cocaine and heroin and LSD and all that other bad stuff. But there are, I believe, 15 states that have legalized medical, if not actually recreational, marijuana. And that takes away a lot of the power from the federal government, because the federal government does not have the resources to enforce these federal laws at the state level. In one of these articles, they mention that if the DEA wanted to raid all of the dispensaries in Los Angeles, it would take, I don't remember the exact number, but a significant portion of their budget. I don't remember if it was 40% or 80%, but it was one of those, it's a really, really big chunk. And that would be to raid all of the dispensaries in one city, in one state. They would run out of money before they left California. And there's something like 90% of all of these arrests, even though they're arrested under federal statute, it's done with the cooperation of the local police, usually county or city level, sometimes state level. And so if you can get your states to simply say, we're not going to do it, we're not going to prosecute this at the state level, I'm sorry, Mr. DEA man, but if you want to do it, you're going to have to do it yourself. We have more important things to do. You are going to severely hamper their efforts. And that is how the marijuana crowd, the weed people, have managed to get not just their foot in the door, but a good chunk of their leg. And I think that is something that we, the gun people, need to take a page from. I'm just about at the point of saying that the federal government, regardless of who's in power, because believe me, I've said a lot of things under Republican administrations too, I don't think it does any good. I think that both the left and the right are authoritarians. They love big government. It's just a matter of what flavor big government they like. For those of us who prefer small government, we've got to act on a smaller scale. And so I think it's time to start pressuring your state-level Congress critters, your state-level senators and representatives and your county representatives and your chief of police and all these people, and do what the weed people were doing. And the thing is, we actually have an easier time of it in theory, because there's nothing in the Bill of Rights about the right of the people to keep and smoke weed shall not be infringed. But the Second Amendment is there. And you can make a really good case, and hopefully, well, it's like we saw in Virginia. God, I don't even remember if it was 2020 or 2019 or whatever, when there were a bunch of counties in Virginia that were declaring themselves Second Amendment sanctuaries. And I think that there is a very real possibility for this to happen with certain states. And if you can just get a state that will say, no, we're not going to enforce these gun control laws, you're going to have to do it yourself, the government is going to find itself very impotent very quickly. And so I think that's where we need to focus our effort. I don't think... really, I'm not saying we should neglect Washington, D.C., but, you know, just let it fester and let's work to make it irrelevant and ignore it. And so concentrate on your local efforts. Work with your local gun rights group, whether it's Florida Carry or Virginia Citizens Defense League or whatever it is, and work to pressure your local senators and representatives. And gosh golly, a lot of those people, after they finish their term at state level, then go on to federal level. And maybe after they've been pressured and they see that it works well, and you know, people aren't killing each other in the streets over parking spaces, you know, they might be able, I'm having trouble saying this with a straight face, but they might be able to bring just a little bit of sanity and rationality to Washington, D.C. So, yes, take a page from the weed people and use that to pressure your local representatives to not enforce these highly restrictive gun laws, and see if you can pry their fingers off of the existing gun control laws.
And of course, the interestingness about the weed people is that the gun owners are becoming so much more homogenized now. The people are rushing out to buy guns. If you're on the left, you're seeing what's going on. And you're like, I should probably buy some guns. If you're on the right, you're seeing what's going on. See what's buying guns. If you're those of us in the middle, you're like, I've already got guns and I think I need more. And so what does David have for us, Aaron?
Well, we've all heard this before, but it's information worth repeating. Let's treat new gun owners, especially panic buyers, with kindness and with guidance. David is here to tell us how.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. I'm calling this segment New Year, New Gun. If the content sounds familiar, that's because it's based heavily on one I did a few months into the gun panic buying that started last April. With all the news agencies still banging the COVID-19 drum almost a year later, state and local governments continuing to try and outdo each other with restrictions, fear and uncertainty about the recent election, the shenanigans at the Capitol, and still no end in sight, people are more scared than ever. Where I work, lots of people are coming in looking for something with which to defend Fort Charmin. Many of these people are first-time customers. Some of them have told me they never even imagined they would ever own a gun. Over the past 8 months or so, I've also had more private lessons for first-time gun owners than since the store opened over 3 years ago. This, at least, is comforting. It's good to see people new to firearms taking the responsible step of learning proper and safe gun handling. As I've mentioned previously, I live in Tennessee, and the process here to purchase a firearm, even a handgun, from a dealer is pretty simple. All people need to do is fill out the federal Form 4473, get run through the state background check system, and assuming they get a proceed on that, pay for their gun and take it home. The process to get a carry license, while slightly more involved, is still simpler and less time-consuming, and less expensive, than many other states. However, people in other parts of the country are not as fortunate and may find themselves running face first into laws they were unaware of or may even have supported in the past. As we interact with these prospective new gun owners, there are some concepts I'd like everyone to try to keep in mind. Compassion, not indifference. This is not the time to point and laugh. This is the time for calm and patient explanations. Help them understand what the laws are and, if appropriate, some of the history behind those laws. If you can, assist them in navigating local firearm laws. If you're unsure yourself, introduce them to a knowledgeable person or direct them to a reputable website. Inform, don't lecture. These people are generally not part of the firearm community. They may not have any knowledge about this subject at all. Clips and magazines are equally foreign and strange, and the made-up term assault weapon is something real and frightening to their understanding. We want them to be safe, because sure as governments love power, any mishap with firearms will be laid at our feet. Let them know where they can get training. If you don't know yourself, reach out to one of the local volunteer instructors with Operation Blazing Sword. Guide, don't dismiss. In the store where I work, we've sold out of shotguns several times. As of the date I'm recording this, we only have 6 AR-style rifles left in stock, and almost no ammunition. We're still getting stock in on a regular basis. However, someone may want a pump shotgun. Maybe because they erroneously believe the sound of the action will scare away criminals. Maybe because that's what they read about, or what they were told to get. Now they're frantic because there aren't any pump shotguns available. Try guiding them to something else. Maybe they'd be comfortable with a pistol caliber carbine or lever action rifle. Possibly a handgun would fulfill their needs. If you feel they're up to it, an AR can be an excellent choice. As mentioned, this situation is made worse by the limited availability of the most common calibers of ammunition. Buying a 9mm pistol, for example, does very little good if there's no ammunition available for love or money. Obviously, tailor this guidance to their ability and what's currently available in your area. Don't push them too far out of their comfort zone. Just looking at a gun might be all they can handle right now. Educate, don't scold. If you know this person did previously support gun control, point out, again, calmly and patiently, that this is the gun control they supported. Take the time to describe how these laws generally don't stop criminal activity, but do impact peaceable citizens like themselves. They may also feel like a hypocrite for even wanting a gun after a lifetime of believing that guns are inherently bad. This internal conflict can make them even more defensive if they feel pushed. Be informative, not judgmental. Based on what they've been told for many years, all gun owners are terrible, horrible, no good, very bad people, even the ones in Australia. Don't reinforce any of those beliefs. As the saying goes, be the change you want to see in the world. By our actions, these people can potentially become allies. At worst, after this panic is over, hopefully they'll remember our kindness and not judge all gun owners by how the media portrays us. At best, they may become an active member of the firearms community. If not, they may offer to sell us their practically unused guns at a reasonable price later if things return to quote normal, unquote. So whatever state you're in, whatever the laws are, no matter how reasonable or draconian, be compassionate, not indifferent. Inform, don't lecture. Guide, don't dismiss. And educate, don't scold. In the immortal words of Bill S. Preston, Esquire, be excellent to each other. I've included some links that Weird will put in the show notes. Won't you, Weird?
All right, I'm doing the thing.
That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook page and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
Yeah, you more or less heard that segment before, but David decided to essentially update it and resubmit it. And you know what? I definitely have to say, at the start of a new year, I think it's a good message to be out there. Is we need to open doors and we need to invite these new people in and let them know that they're welcome and that we need them. Because again, these are the people that we need to make these phone calls and start getting these balls in motion to start taking back some of our rights.
Gun owners, usually, not always, but most of the time, become gun voters.
So, moving on, Oddball got extra internet famous. So he was over at Oleg Volk's house, and Oleg Volk took a video of Oddball shooting his review sample of the brand new Kel-Tec P50. And since the internet has been so curious about this strange gun, I asked Oddball to give his first impressions on a gun that very few have seen.
Welcome to Oddball's Corner Pocket. As followers of the ACP Facebook page already know, I recently purchased an Altor 9mm pistol. Since I bought this interesting little gun with the intention of doing a review, I figured I should actually shoot it. Fortunately, I have a good friend down the road that has a private range in his backyard. So I packed things up and headed over. One of the added benefits of using his backyard range is that I never quite know what I'm going to see or have access to when I show up. On this particular day, one of the things he was playing with is something that has been making big waves on the internet recently. The Kel-Tec P50. He offered to let me handle it and fire off a few rounds. And, well, who am I to decline such an offer? For those that don't know, the P50 is Kel-Tec's new pistol in 5.7x28 that FN designed to be used in the P90 carbine and the 5.7 pistol. The Kel-Tec is a blowback design that uses the 50-round magazine from the P90. Oddly enough, the magazine isn't slapped onto the top like on the P90, but rather it's inserted under the barrel and above the lower receiver. I'll address just how that happens in a little bit. As you can imagine, this means that the pistol is a bit on the large side. It is definitely in the PDW category, and looks like it might be a good replacement for the Blastec E11 currently in use by Imperial forces across the galaxy. Of course, there will be a link in the show notes. I will have to say that it does feel pretty good in the hand. The grip has the square grid pattern that Kel-Tec is known for, which does a pretty good job of being textured enough to give you a good grip, but doesn't hurt your hand or shred anything it's rubbing against, unlike the more stippling school of thought that some go with. Another trademark of Kel-Tec is it is primarily made of plastic, which means that it's not too heavy, even with a full magazine. There are what can only be thought of as finger channels in front of the trigger guard. Placing your offhand there is pretty natural and helps combat the fact that it is a bit front-heavy with a 9.6-inch barrel and the magazine being oriented similar to a rifle's tube magazine. There is a small portion of rail under the barrel that might tempt some to attach a vertical foregrip, but remember that that would be a felony, and it should only be used to attach a light or similar. I would also love to see this with an arm brace, or register it as an SBR and slap a collapsible buttstock on it. Unfortunately, I don't see any way to mount one. The flattest part of the back of the pistol is occupied by the charging handle, which is similar to the straight pull mechanism that's on an AR-15. The back is also the home to a disassembly lever and a sling mount point. Incidentally, there's another sling mount point under the grip, so while you can use a two-point sling, it will effectively be a single-point sling. The top of the gun is primarily occupied by a Picatinny rail. There are the traditional pistol notch and blade sights inside the channel down the middle of the rail. Unfortunately, these sights are clearly designed as an afterthought, and it's very clear that it was intended to be used with an optic. All in all, the gun was pleasant to shoot, it is extremely accurate, and we were having no issues hitting our target at 20 or 25 yards. I would expect in the right hands and with the right optics, there would be no issue hitting targets at 50 or even 100 yards. The light recoil of the 5.7mm round also means that quick and accurate follow-up shots are easy. So, I mentioned that I would talk about changing magazines. It's a process. First, you should make sure that the gun is cocked, which, since there's no empty mag hold open, means that you'll probably need to use the charging handle after pulling the trigger on an empty chamber. After that, hit the disassembly lever on the back, and the upper receiver and magazine hinge forward. Swap out the magazines, make sure that the hammer is back, and close it back up. After that, you might want to charge it again to actually load a round into the chamber. This works, but it's not exactly quick and easy, and it means that at some point in the process, you will probably have the barrel and a closed chamber pointed at your crotch. Also, the gun will open with the hammer down, but it won't close with the hammer down. Of course, with 50 rounds per magazine, reloads would be few and far between, and hopefully any serious work you would ever see yourself doing with this thing would be over within that 50 rounds. So, what's the final conclusion? It's an interesting firearm. At an MSRP of $995 that includes two magazines, it is significantly cheaper than the civilian FN PS90, and about in the middle between the price points of the FN-57 and the Ruger 57. I'm not sure that I'd strap this big boy to my hip, but I could see it serving as a home defense gun, or PDW, or trunk gun, and is definitely a fun range toy. If I were in the market for something in 5.7 by 28, I think this would be a strong contender, and I wouldn't fault anyone for going for it over what's already on the market. Incidentally, I feel that I must point out that what I was shooting was either a pre-production or very early production unit. It is possible that there will be some changes to the firearm before it truly goes into mass market production, and you see them on the shelves. Also, due to the current ammo crisis, we only had 50 rounds of ammo on hand. It did not have any failures to fire for me, or for any of the other folks there, but I cannot comfortably make any statements on its reliability. Okay, so maybe next time I'll actually get to talk about that Alator I meant to review here. If you would like to read more of my thoughts, you can find me at gunscarstech.com. If you have any thoughts, questions, or ideas for future segments, I can be found at oddball@gunscarstech.com or on the Assorted Calibers Facebook page. Until next time, have a good one.
So I'm really amused by the break action, because when someone was describing it to me, I was like, oh my God, you mean like a break action revolver? And they said, well, not quite. It's a lot more like, well, when you are loading an ammunition belt into like an M60 or an M249. Mm-hmm. And that has led some people to speculate just how difficult it would be to convert this to belt fed.
I mean,
and I'm interested. You have my attention on that. I don't know. I don't even know if there are links sized for 5.7 yet, but that's certainly very interesting.
Yeah. And also, I've got to just publicly thank Oddball for this, because essentially I saw this video first thing in the morning and I was just like, Oddball, I want you, I know you want to talk about your Altor, but I want you to talk about this first. And can you come on Handgun Radio? And so, yeah, Oddball was burning some midnight oil for this segment. But I really thought it was important. I really wanted to get out there because it's crazy. It's cool. Like, Caltech is just comes up with some wild designs. And I gotta love that. And actually, this got me thinking about one of the other Caltech wild designs. I mean, obviously, I think it's your mom has the PMR-30 pistol.
Correct.
Yeah, that's that is the 22 Winchester Magnum pistol. And mm-hmm. I don't know if they made very many of these or all that. I don't think I've only seen a couple of them in the wild, but they also made a CMR-30, which essentially was a long barrel and a collapsible stock on this pistol. And I wanted to point out, Oddball was asking about how could you put a stock on this thing. And essentially the CMR-30 had kind of a very similar to some of the MP5 submachine guns, where essentially it's got the two rails that ride along the side of the receiver. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if Caltech could make that work. And I think Q Industries has a pistol brace that works off of a similar thing. I think I've seen them do some pistols that had an arm brace that was retractable on it like that. But yeah, that just popped into my mind.
I'm guessing the reason they haven't made a pistol version of this is because the tip up would be very ungainly if you had a rifle length barrel. On the other hand, if you were to SBR it, that would certainly be a thing you could do.
Yes.
Probably not justifiable for Caltech to make them. But, you know, it's one of those, well, if you were to register it, we've got this compatible stock.
Yeah, I mean, it's a crazy gun. And I wish Caltech would have the infrastructure to produce as many as people want, because I think the demand for these things is going to far exceed their manufacturing capacity.
That's pretty standard for Caltech, really.
I mean, it really is.
Okay, so I've had this handed in front of me. It is some pre-written text by Weird. So here we have Aaron reading Weird script. Some people called it a beef. Others saw it as a friendly discussion. But Ian McCollum of Forgotten Weapons and Logan Medish of High Caliber History got into an exchange about museums in the modern era. I being Weird, of course, sat down with Logan to get his take on what a modern museum curator does behind the scenes at your local museum.
I would like to welcome back to the Assorted Calibers podcast firearms historian Logan Medish. Logan, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty darn good. How are you today?
I am doing good, but Logan, you started a little beef.
A little beef, big beef, quarter pounder, third pounder. Where's the beef?
What? Yeah, since we both know Ian McCollum very well, I knew under no circumstances there was a beef, but some people thought it was a beef. I'll have it linked in the show notes. It's too long to explain, but Ian made some fairly controversial, and he knew they were going to be controversial, statements about museums and their usefulness in the day of the internet. And of course, you had a brilliant rebuttal video that again, there's just too much to go into. They'll both be in the show notes because they're awesome. But one of the things that got into is Ian mentioned that he felt that museum curators really were doing more mundane tasks than doing the more important tasks of a museum curator. And I think you had a little bit of an issue with that, didn't you?
Yeah, a little bit. And you touched on it a little bit here, but I just want to reinforce it. Yeah, I know Ian, he knows me, and, you know, and I watched his video, and before I sat down to record mine, I texted him and told him, hey, I watched your video. I'm going to do a response reaction video, just a heads up. And he was like, yeah, cool. Send me the link to it when you're done. I want to check it out. So it's one of those celebrity beefs that we both do to get headlines and tabloids and all that good stuff. But anyway, no. Yeah. So he was saying that museum folks, you know, spend a lot of time, you know, bogged down in red tape, and they don't have a chance to do as much original research and things of that nature as one might hope. And to a certain extent, yeah, that's true. You know, they say, well, is that true? And you say, well, short answer, yes, with an if; long answer, no, with a but. And it depends on the size of the institution that you're working at, and it depends on your specific role. Museum folks tend to wear lots and lots of hats. The smaller the museum, the more hats. So you may have less time for, you know, research and writing if you're also the head toilet scrubber and tour guide, as well as the curator. But if you're at a bigger institution, you know, you are more solely focused on the collection items themselves, and you have a little bit more of a free rein, if you will, in your day to focus on your actual job interests and the items in the museum themselves.
So honestly, what I really wanted to get down to is when I heard that that response, I really wanted to hear, especially since you have worked in I know you've worked in the NRA museum. Have you worked in other firearms museums?
Not other firearms museums, but I've worked in a number of other museums of varying sizes. I worked in a historic house museum, you know, with just a handful of people on staff. And, you know, I did everything from cataloging archaeological objects to, you know, restocking toilet paper and giving tours. I worked for the National Park Service, specifically just working with museum collections. And I worked for the Smithsonian Institution at one point as well, working just with museum collections and cataloging. And again, you know, the Park Service and the Smithsonian are the much larger institutions, obviously, where you get to specialize and focus more specifically on your stuff as opposed to having to wear many, many hats.
Mm-hmm. So I guess we, since it's the Assorted Calibers podcast, we could corral it tighter to the firearms things. But obviously, just museums in general is also kind of the purview of this. Is what are some of the day to day, not mundane tasks? Obviously, you might be giving tours. If we've been to a museum, you've seen a museum tour. We understand what that is. And just about all of us have scrubbed floors and dusted things and cleaned toilets. if that in fact was the purview, and trust me, I've had a half a dozen jobs where, yeah, I did a little bit of everything. But as far as the specialty side of it, and I would actually say more on the behind the scenes, like what is it that happens behind those employees only doors at museums that we might not know about?
Sure. Yeah, there's a lot more hands-on with the collection than you might think. And some of that is just making sure that the collection is still in proper order and that things are still being well cared for. Or sometimes, you know, we have a research inquiry, someone from the outside is curious about a certain aspect of a piece. You know, for example, like someone is curious about a Palmetto single shot pistol and trying to figure out if the parts are, you know, if it's legit or if it's repro or things have been changed. So, you know, we might end up disassembling the gun and, you know, how thick exactly with a pair of calipers is the lock plate or the tang on the back of it, things of that nature. So there are things that we do get to do and get into and really get hands on with the collection. You know, it's more than just wandering galleries, looking at stuff behind glass and dusting.
And so, yeah. And so you would be just, yeah, diving into source material and researching the provenance on that. And I, as curious as I am to ask more questions, I know that's a rabbit hole that we do not have the time to get into. I guess you talk about taking apart too. Is preservation part of the day to day when a piece comes into the museum?
Yes. And it varies depending on, you know, what other staff are available. You know, at a bigger institution, you're going to have conservators on staff, and it'll be their job to go through and do the active conservation. But when I worked at the National Firearms Museum, we were a small staff of seven. And so conservation, it was more of just a preventative conservation. You know, we were making sure there wasn't any active rust, you know, making sure stuff isn't binding or gummed up, or there's not, you know, stress on springs where there doesn't need to be or shouldn't be. But in terms of, you know, doing an active full blown, you know, conservation, restoration, you know, things of that nature, that's not what the purpose of that museum was and not what the purpose of the collection was. So we did minor stuff, you know, just to keep the collection from destroying itself, but not actively restoring stuff.
And so one last thing that I think we could probably get into is, I'll do a hypothetical here in the fact that, you know, you might end up getting a donation from somebody who is, you know, essentially an avid collector themselves, and they're donating it to the museum because they want the world to see it rather than it be just, you know, in their own private collection anymore. And so they may have volumes of research they've done. But what would happen if, say, you got an estate sale or something and a historic item gets in and you know that it's of historic provenance, but how exactly would you go through actually tracking down the information on it, be it a gun or a Chippendale dresser?
Yeah, so thankfully, there are a lot of great people who have come before us that have put together a lot of fantastic reference material, on, like I said, whether it, you know, be a single action army or a Chippendale piece of furniture. And the beautiful thing is that while the museum community is vast, it's also small, and we often tend to know, those specialists, or we know someone who knows that specialist and we can get that introduction. So we try to go, you know, as direct to the source as possible to figure out the provenance. You know, for guns, that may be contacting company historians and verifying things through factory letters and things of that nature. So that we can say, you know, definitively, you know, this was Annie Oakley's gun and here's the proof. Sometimes it doesn't turn up that way. You know, you dive down the rabbit hole and you find out that, you know, instead of there being gold in the rabbit hole, there's just rabbit turds in the rabbit hole. And so, that gun that, you know, belonged to Annie Oakley, well, now it's, you know, purported to have belonged to Annie Oakley, or, you know, family story says it was, you know, belonged to Annie Oakley. If you can't prove it definitively, the ethical thing is to not say it definitively.
Well, that is awesome. And I wanted to get a little bit more into just that little section of your video. Again, the Ian's video, which is excellent, as well as yours, are in the show notes, as well as a link to your podcast. I just wanted to say you're doing a podcast now.
Yeah, I am. And because I am an incredibly creative and innovative person, the name of it is very simply the High Caliber History Podcast, just like my company. And you can find that on my website, highcaliberhistory.com, or you can find it on any of your favorite podcast streaming places, whether it's Google Podcast, iTunes. There's a video version on YouTube. But yeah, you just search for High Caliber History in your podcasts and it'll show up.
Yeah, I'll just say as a personal recommendation, I will say that if you like gun nut sort of stuff, I will say that Logan has access to certain people that the other gun nut podcasts really don't. And so the interviews that you've got there are really awesome. I haven't listened to everything just yet, but oh boy, I've enjoyed everything that I've heard.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it, and I'm sure the other listeners here from Assorted Calibers, if you like this show, I think you'll like my show as well.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the show. That's Logan Medish of High Caliber History.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm really happy that Logan is doing a podcast because we need more awesome podcasts. But at the same time, I got to admit, I was holding out hope that he might become a regular contributor for us. And now that he's doing his own thing, he can't do that.
Well, the good news is that he's a good guy and he's accessible. So, yeah, no, I call him regularly, like, hey, Logan, come on the show. so it works out well. But again, I said it in the interview, but man, you got to listen to this podcast. It is really, really cool, especially if you like Weird Beard and you like old guns.
Here's what I want. We've all heard of the concept of the supergroup, like the Highwaymen, where you get people who are stars in their own right. You know, Waylon Jennings and Kris Kristofferson and Willie Nelson. You know, they're all good musicians in their own right, and they all come together to form a band, and they kick ass. I gotta admit, I want to see a super group of gun people come together, including, you know, Ian McCollum, Logan Medish, like Hickok 45, maybe some others, you know, the Tal Fledermaus, that zany guy from Demolition Ranch, and just, okay, put you all together. Even if it's garbage, it's going to be hilarious garbage, and who knows, there might be magic.
Well, they made a zombie movie. I think it either came out or is coming out with all of the YouTube gun personalities into it. And actually, I think our own house Dick was in it. Steve, I forget what it was called now.
I thought that was one of the things that was made by Matt Best.
I think it may have been.
I didn't think it contained gun personnel. But the thing is, they might have been acting. I'm talking about literally, let's get all these people together and let's have them talk about guns. Let's have them do what they do best. But just, you know, it'll either be gold or it'll at least be entertaining garbage. That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, the movie is Strain 100. And yeah, but it is a work of fiction, but is, yeah, a whole bunch of essentially YouTube gun personalities doing gun stuff, shooting zombies, and Steve was a zombie.
Well, good for him.
Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibers podcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film track, and the ACP mag dump.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts, subscribe to us on the platform of your choice, and share the show with your friends both online and off.
You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com, and hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network with Oddball in the latest episode.
So you know where to find me, blah, 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 blah. I want to let people know, if you bought an Operation Blazing Sword patch over the last few years, you might be interested to know that a really super cool pistols patch has come out. It's circular, it's 3.5 inches, there are pictures all over my social media, and just like the OBS patch, they are $10 each. We had a smaller run, they only come with the Velcro backing, but if you contact me, you know, for a $10 donation, you get a patch, and they are really super awesome. So if you want one, contact me, and I will hook you up.
That's awesome. And what's also awesome is Nate Spencer's music.
We'll just shoehorn that in there.
I ad-lib. I'm allowed to.
So So I've got a really cool patch and he doesn't, because he hasn't ordered one yet, because he's lame and sucks. And not in a fun way either. Our patch owningness is assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.